It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
On immunity, very simple. If a president of the United States does not have immunity, he'll be totally ineffective because he won't be able to do anything because it will mean he'll be prosecuted, strongly prosecuted perhaps, as soon as he leaves office by the opposing party.
Donald Trump has been arguing in and out of the courtroom that he has absolute presidential immunity from criminal charges that he plotted to overturn the 2020 election. The D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, in a unanimous opinion, categorically rejected that argument. But Trump is now asking the Supreme Court to intervene. Trump wants the justices to put that D.C. opinion on hold while he appeals it, which will continue to delay his criminal trial for election interference. It was the second time in less than a week that Trump has asked the justices to intervene in a major case that would smooth the road for his presidential campaign. The justices are already considering whether states can bar him from this year's presidential ballot because of his role in the January 6th Capitol riot. Joining me is Dave Arenberg, Palm Beach County State Attorney. Dave, what was your general impression of Trump's application to the Supreme Court for a stay?
I thought the application for a stay was pretty weak. For example, he cited as a reason for the Supreme Court to grant a stay that his own supporters' First Amendment rights would be taken away. And that doesn't make any sense. First off, Trump is the defendant, not his supporters. And although he likes to nationalize everything where he makes any attack on him an attack on the country or the MAGA universe, it may play in the court of public opinion in the far right wing media, but not in a court of law. So you cannot go to the Supreme Court and say, I have irreparable harm. You must give me a stay, because if you don't give me a stay, you're going to violate my supporters' First Amendment rights to choose who they want as president. No, that's ridiculous. Nothing stops your supporters from voting for you. You can even be elected from a jail cell. So I think the Supreme Court is going to reject this request for a stay. You need five justices to go along with it. And I don't think he's going to get that. And if I'm right, that means this case will be sent back to the D.C. court and it'll be game on for Judge Chutkan and Jack Smith. And that trial for election interference will be heard before the election.
Let's talk about some of the arguments that Trump made in his application. At the circuit court, he had argued that former presidents are absolutely immune from prosecution. And we've all heard by now Judge Florence Pan's hypothetical about a president ordering SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a rival. And he didn't seem to retreat from that argument in the Supreme Court filing.
Yeah, they try to nuance it a little bit, but that's a sure loser. I mean, presidents don't have absolute immunity. It's ludicrous to think that you could assassinate your political rival, and unless you are impeached by the House and convicted by the Senate, then you get away scot-free, that you can't be charged. You get a get-out-of-jail-free card. Then just change the title of president to king, because that's what we would have. But there's a reason why we left the crown many years ago, because we don't have a king. We have a rule of law, and it applies to everyone. And the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals understood that. They ruled unanimously against Trump. And the Supreme Court's not going to accept that argument either. Now, could they take the case, grant cert, which only requires four justices, not five, and review the matter and issue a ruling to clarify the law of immunity in certain cases? Sure, I could see that happening, but I don't see them granting a stay here, which would make it a lot harder to try Trump before the election. So that's my best guess. Now, I think, on the other hand, when it comes to the other case of whether Trump can make the ballot in Colorado and other states, I think they're going to rule overwhelmingly for Trump. So I think this is a little bit of a give and take. They're going to rule for Trump that he can stay on the ballot, but against Trump here. That's my prediction.
His counsel said the special counsel seeks urgently to force President Trump into a months-long criminal trial at the height of campaign season, effectively sidelining him and preventing him from campaigning against the current president. I mean, is that his new argument, that he shouldn't even face trial before the election? Is he somehow swinging for the fences?
Yeah, he wants you to believe he's out there on a bus tour around the country, going from town to town, shaking hands, kissing babies. No, he's usually just campaigning from Mar-a-Lago on his Truth Social media site. And so this doesn't stop him from campaigning. He could be in a trial and still do his campaigning, and that won't have an effect. But you can also say that going through a trial and having a verdict actually helps the public, because most of the public in polls show that they want to know the result of this case, because it'll help them give them more information on whom to vote for. If he's found guilty, that is important to voters. If he's acquitted, that will be important to voters. But if this is stalled till past the election, the voters won't get the information they need to make a fully informed decision on perhaps the most consequential election of our lifetimes. So I think that argument doesn't hold water. Also, he's the one who's making this political. Jack Smith and Merrick Garland don't want to bring up politics in this. They want to stay above the political fray. So Jack Smith has not specifically mentioned that we need to get going sooner than later because there's an election coming up. He doesn't want to mention the E word, but Trump is, because when it comes to election interference, he is trying to use that to delay his case. He's the one who's using the election to try to get away with this, because he doesn't have a better defense than delay, delay, delay.
Yeah, and that was one thing, actually, I thought that rang true in their application, that Jack Smith has not specifically said why it's so important that this case go forward so quickly. Do you think he has to do that at some point?
Yeah, it's like Jack Smith doesn't want to break the code. He and Merrick Garland are so nervous about being seen as political that they don't want to mention the E word. No, 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 don't mention it. Just pretend that it doesn't exist, but you can't. This is why the Supreme Court refused to intervene originally. Remember, Jack Smith went to the Supreme Court originally on this matter to say, please intervene. You can Bigfoot the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. We don't have to go through those middlemen. Why don't you just do it now? But the reason why the Supreme Court said no is because Jack Smith never told them why this is such an emergency. And the real emergency is because there's an election, but Jack Smith doesn't want to acknowledge there's an election coming up. So the Supreme Court said, then there's no emergency. Unless you want to say the magic words, we're not going to give you the relief. So it's interesting. Now Jack Smith is telling the Supreme Court, don't get involved. So maybe the best argument Trump has is that Jack Smith went to you, urging you to get involved just a short time ago. Now he doesn't want you to get involved. So that's a contradiction.
Yeah, Smith had argued that it was of imperative public importance that the Supreme Court be the one to resolve Trump's immunity claims. So I don't know how he's going to handle that when he files his papers.
Well, the way to do it is just to say the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals opinion, which took a lot longer than people thought, is very thorough, very strong. Just defer to that. You don't need to go through this. Just defer to what they just did. You don't need to go any further. You don't need to recreate the wheel. And that may work, because the Supreme Court is a busy institution, and maybe they don't want to step into this any more than they have to. And they can just deny cert, deny the stay, and let things play out.
Trump also asked for a step that could produce additional delay. He requests that the justices grant a stay and hold off any further action until the D.C. Circuit Court decides whether to reconsider the case en banc, meaning in front of the court's full 11-judge bench. But he would have to petition the D.C. Circuit Court for an en banc hearing. And that's rare, and they probably wouldn't grant it in light of the comprehensive opinion by the 3-judge panel.
This is an example of Trump wanting to have it both ways. He wants to have both pie and ice cream for dessert. And maybe that's at the buffet at Mar-a-Lago. But in real life, what he's trying to do is to say that I want to go back to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. I want them to hear this case en banc, which means the full court, not just a 3-judge panel. And at the same time, I want a stay from the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals told Trump that you get either or. You can either go back to us and ask for the en banc hearing, but if you do that, there's no stay, then Judge Chutkan can start moving on her case, or you can go straight to the Supreme Court, and then you can seek a stay there. Trump is saying, no, I want both. I want to go back to the full court, and I want the stay. And you know why, June, he wants to go back to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, when he knows that court, which is made up mostly of Democratic-appointed judges, will never rule for him. But the reason why he wants to go back is because it furthers his strategy of delay. He wants every last hearing he can have, because every day that goes by without a trial is a victory for Donald Trump.
Let's say there are five justices to grant a stay. How long do you think it will take to move that stay through the Supreme Court? You know, they'll probably have oral arguments scheduled.
Yeah, if there is a stay, then it makes it a lot harder to try this case before the election. I don't think it's impossible. I think if there's no stay, I think that then this will be tried by the end of spring. At least the start of the trial will happen by the end of spring. If there is a stay, then they'll be lucky to try this in the summertime, and then it gets close to the election. So if the Supreme Court does give the stay and grant cert, then we just don't know how long it will take. The Supreme Court knows this is a matter of great public importance and it requires urgency. So I don't think they'll go that far, but they may, but they still need five votes. And it's not just that they're going to agree that there's irreparable harm. They'd have to say, the five justices who grant a stay, that there's a likelihood of success on the merits. Really? You think Trump's going to win on his claim of absolute immunity? That five justices, a majority, would say, yeah, we think he's got a good case. That's why I don't think that he wins on the stay. I don't think there's irreparable harm, and I definitely don't think there's a likelihood of success on the merits.
So what about if four justices say, let's take this case for review?
Now, I think that could happen. All it takes is four justices, not a majority, but four justices to grant cert, which is granting certiorari, which means we're going to take up the case. But that doesn't mean there's a stay. A stay requires five justices. So they could take up the case and say, we're going to review it, you know, to decide the matter of absolute immunity, and we want to write an opinion about it. But then if there's no stay, then Judge Chutkan can start moving the ball forward. And then, assuming the court rules on this issue in a timely fashion and rejects Trump's claim of absolute immunity, then the trial can go forward. But as long as there's no stay, then the preliminaries can start going ahead, and then they can set a trial date, and then it's game on. So I think the bigger question for me is not whether they grant cert, it's whether they grant the stay. Trump would rather have the stay than the cert, because he's more concerned about the delay than the ultimate opinion.
And I have to say, his legal team has been very good at creating delays in all his cases. Coming up next, we'll discuss why Trump and his team went into a closed-door meeting with the judge presiding over his criminal case for mishandling classified documents. I'm June Grasso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
On the same day Trump's attorneys filed papers asking the Supreme Court to intervene in his criminal case on charges of plotting to overturn the 2020 election, the former president arrived to a crowd of supporters at a federal courthouse in Florida for a closed hearing in the criminal case charging him with mishandling classified documents and obstructing FBI efforts to get them back. A Trump campaign message to allies had the subject line, quote, I'm in court again, warning that unspecified opponents, quote, want me arrested and erased from the ballot. Of course, that refers to another case before the Supreme Court about whether states can bar Trump from this year's presidential ballot because of his role in the January 6th riot. The Florida court hearing was closed to the public to discuss the procedures for handling classified evidence in the trial that's currently set for May 20th. Trial Judge Aileen Cannon, a Trump appointee, set arguments from defense attorneys in the morning and from prosecutors in the afternoon, each outside of the other's presence. I've been talking to Dave Ehrenberg, the Palm Beach County State Attorney. Dave, we don't know exactly what went on in these hearings, but give us the gist of what's happening.
I think what's happening is that Judge Cannon, who is pretty new at this, is trying to be very thorough and wants to hear from both sides, when this hearing really didn't even have to take place, or at least they could have done this a while ago. But this has been delayed, and now they have all these different hearings. That's why this case will never be heard before the election. Trump gets what he wants there. But what they're talking about is whether under Section 4 of SEPA, which is this federal act dealing with classified documents, whether the government can keep some of these classified documents concealed out of the discovery process, not having to show them to the defense, even though Donald Trump, the defendant, is going to be prosecuted based on some of these documents. But there is a provision in the law in Section 4 that gives the government the power. But the defense says, no, we want it all. And here's our defense case, which is why they met separately with a judge. This is why we want it all. This is our case. And we also want the names of some of these witnesses involved. And Jack Smith is saying, no, no, no. If we give you some of these names of some of these individuals who we're working with, then you're going to harass them and you're going to intimidate them and threaten them. So no, we want to keep a lot of this stuff secret. So this is the battle going on right now. And so far, Judge Cannon has been ruling for the defendant, Donald Trump. And Jack Smith is saying, please reconsider. And if you don't reconsider, subtle threat, we can go to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. Remember what happened last time we went to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals? Now, he didn't say that specifically, but that's the underlying threat. Because the last time that Jack Smith went to the 11th Circuit, not only did they repudiate Judge Cannon, but they pulled her off the case when she was involved before there were charges filed.
Judge Cannon had ruled that Smith's team had to file a cache of documents on the public docket. But in a motion last week, Smith asked her to reconsider, saying it would reveal, as you say, the names of potential witnesses and also sensitive information. And then he put in that little warning. He said it would be clear error, and he cited the 11th Circuit. If he goes to the 11th Circuit and they rule against her, could they also decide to take her off the case? It's unusual, but it's been done, hasn't it?
Well, yeah, they took her off the case last time, but that was before charges were filed. Here, I think what they would do, they would probably not take her off until Jack Smith requested it. Jack Smith would have to make a motion to recuse her. I don't think that they would take her off sua sponte, meaning on their own. But I guess anything's possible because this is not her first rodeo here. She got involved last year when she shouldn't have in the selection of the special master. She halted this entire investigation. She got in the way of an executive branch investigation before charges were filed and halted it and appointed a special master. And then the 11th Circuit said, wait, you can't do this. And publicly humiliated her and took her off the case. It's different, though, once you're the judge officially assigned to a case that has been filed. And so I think that she can get repudiated again and reversed, but I'm not so sure they're going to remove her from the case unless there's a specific request and grounds filed by Jack Smith.
Does he have the grounds, you think? I mean, you know, to outside observers, she's in over her head.
Well, being in over your head and being biased are two different things. If you can show from outside observers that it's clear she's evidencing bias, then yeah, then that's how you get her removed. But the standard is pretty high. It's a high hurdle to reach. And if it was easy, Jack Smith would have done so already. But I do think it's a possibility because how many times do you have to see these rulings go against you to start to say, maybe we should find another judge? But if it's because of inexperience, they're less likely to remove her from the case. If it's because she is demonstrating bias of the person who appointed her to the bench, then yeah, and then she'd be removed. And no one wants that. That would be a real humiliation for her. So we'll see. Jack Smith has not pressed that nuclear button yet. And I think he's getting closer to it every day.
Trump's lawyers have access to certain of these documents. They've been looking at them in a SCIF, a sensitive compartmented information facility. Why do they need access to all of them? How does seeing the classified documents help their case? Trump had documents he wasn't supposed to have and refused to return them. What does it matter what the details in those documents are? Are they going to argue, well, Trump was entitled to have this classified document but not that one? Can you tell what their strategy is here?
Yeah, well, they want to have as many hearings as possible. They want to have as many motions because they want to delay this well past the election, because this is the strongest case that prosecutors have against Donald Trump of any of the cases. But they got the right judge, a new judge who is slow walking this case, and now they're making all these motions. But I think in the end, the government will give him a little more leeway they would to other defendants in the same situation, because he's a former president, because at one point he did have legitimate access to many of these documents, but there are some documents that he did not have access to because they would be after he was president, and he has them and kept them, and he may never have even reviewed them beforehand. We don't know. But there's some documents that are so secretive that they think that in the hands of even a former president, they would be a national security risk. So we just don't know exactly what they are.
You mentioned before keeping witnesses' names secret. And so there's been a fight over the identity of witnesses, with special counsel Jack Smith detailing threats against prosecutors, judges, and other witnesses. There was also a prospective government witness recently received threats over social media that are now the subject of federal investigation. And Trump said in the court filing, there's no compelling interest in keeping the information sealed and no legal reason to redact the names. Why do they have an interest in publishing the names? A legal interest.
I don't think that they do, although they may say we need to know all the witnesses and evidence against us. And we have a Sixth Amendment right to confront our accusers. And if there's going to be a witness against us, we want to know. On the other hand, we've seen already in other cases where witnesses have been intimidated. And if their identities get out, they can go into hiding, or they may try to change their story. And the government does not want that to happen. So they're appealing to Judge Cannon to keep some of this stuff secret. Judge Cannon has been resistant so far, and that's going to be the matter of contention before the 11th Circuit if Judge Cannon doesn't change her opinion.
Because, you know, I've seen trials where police officers who are undercover or different kinds of agents, their identity is protected. They don't even give their name when they testify. So it seems like there's plenty of reason here.
Exactly. Exactly. We're dealing with a political movement here, which has used threats of violence against its enemies. I mean, I don't need to bring up, there have been many instances of that where Donald Trump will put out a tweet against the FBI, and then someone shows up at the FBI headquarters in Cincinnati and shoots it up. Or he puts out information about Barack Obama and where he lives in Georgetown, and then all of a sudden someone shows up in a van with weapons in the van right around Obama's house. So we've seen this kind of stuff. And then, of course, there's January 6th. So the government has reason to keep some of this stuff secret. There's a reason why in the last trial against Donald Trump, the one involving E. Jean Carroll, that the judge made all the jurors anonymous and weren't even allowed to identify them, their real names, to each other. So this is what happens when you have radicals inside of a political movement hell-bent on violence.
Now let's go back to Trump at the closed-door hearing. So he was there for hours. It seemed to be about strategy, procedure, along those lines. So not something he had to attend at all. He has been appearing at more hearings lately. He plans to attend the Thursday hearing in Atlanta, Georgia, on allegations that the Fulton County District Attorney, Fannie Willis, engaged in an improper relationship with the lead prosecutor in that election interference case. We know that when he appears in court, he often makes statements outside about how unfair the proceedings are or about the witch hunt, etc. But he didn't do that in Florida. I'm wondering why you think he chose to go to this particular hearing.
Well, the cynic in me would say that Donald Trump, who is very transactional, wanted to show up inside the chambers of a judge that he appointed to have a subtle reminder that the reason why she's where she is because of him. And no words need to be said. And he goes in there with his entourage, and perhaps he's hoping that she'll be starry-eyed or be reminded that this is the guy who appointed you, made your career. And so he was there. And we'll see. It's so far, she's ruled for him in just about every matter, so it hasn't mattered whether he's shown up or not. But I just have to believe the only reason why he would show up in a closed-door matter in a situation like this, in a complex case, is just that. Also, as compared to Atlanta or New York, Fort Pierce is a lot closer to where he lives
True.
In Palm Beach.
True. So now Judge Cannon has scheduled a hearing for March 1st on whether the trial can go forward in May as scheduled. I take it you agree with most legal experts that there's no way this trial is going forward in May.
No way. No way. This case was never going to go in May because Judge Cannon is new. It's a complex SEPA matter, classified documents. You got federal law. You've got to do these private reviews of documents. you've got the ability for government under Section 4 of SEPA to keep documents private and then to litigate it. And then you just have to look at her passage. She's a ruling for the defendant in this case pretty much from the beginning. So I was thinking that this case will never be heard before the election. And then you have other cases. I think the only case that will be heard, that I really believe will be heard, will be the D.C. election interference case, because I do believe that that's going to trial. The other case that could get heard is the New York case involving Stormy Daniels' hush money payments. I do not believe the Fulton County case will get heard. I think that one is complex. There's many different defendants in a RICO matter. Now you have all the controversy involving the DA there, Fonnie Willis. So I'd say the case that I think most likely will be heard will be in D.C., and next likely would be in New York. But no, unfortunately, the strongest case against Donald Trump, the one in Fort Pierce involving the Mar-a-Lago documents, is the least likely to be heard before the election.
It's been so great talking to you, Dave. Thanks so much. That's Dave Ehrenberg, Palm Beach County State Attorney. Coming up next on the Bloomberg Law Show, how conservative and liberal justices have switched tactics in applying procedural rules that can dictate the outcome of a case. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Have you noticed how many Supreme Court arguments in controversial cases seem to go off on questions of standing? A procedural issue about whether a party has a sufficient stake in the case, sort of skin in the game. And conservative and liberal justices have flipped their positions on standing as the composition of the Supreme Court has gotten more conservative. It's the conservative justices who are now apt to find standing exists in order to allow them to take up challenges to hot-button issues, while the liberal justices are likely to caution against finding standing, raising concerns about an overreaching judiciary. Joining me is Kimberly Strawbridge Robinson, Bloomberg Supreme Court reporter, who's written about this. Kimberly, tell us a little bit about standing and how it's a way for a court to get rid of a case without reaching the merits or the legal issues, or conversely, to take a case that it wants to reach the merits and legal issues.
So, you know, I think it's important to note that this technical issue of standing is a really important concept in the legal field. And, you know, people I talked to said that it really plays an important role in ensuring that judges are only involved in actual disputes between parties. And it's meant as a way to limit, you know, judges from intervening and providing their political view on a case. So, you know, it does play a very important role in sort of limiting the judiciary. The problem that we've seen is that really since its inception, it's been used in a political way. That is, in a way that allows judges to sort of take a very strict view of standing when they get an issue that they'd rather not, you know, weigh into. And on the other hand, to have a really expansive view of standing when it's an issue that they do want to get into. And, you know, that's been really prevalent at the U.S. Supreme Court when we've really seen this flip in the two sides happening between those justices on the right and the left and the way that they use standing.
And you spoke to a professor at UC Davis who said that the Supreme Court has been centrist basically until recently.
I mean, obviously that's debatable, but yeah, you know, the Supreme Court, particularly you think when Justice Kennedy was on the court, there were issues, you know, that would swing either right or left. Now, of course, the Supreme Court is a supermajority of conservative justices. It's a 6-3 divide on the Supreme Court between those that were appointed by Republican versus Democratic appointees. And so we've seen a lot of cases where that sort of centric view of the court really no longer applies.
In your story, and you talk to so many experts, you talk about this change in approach to standing. It used to be that liberals wanted to enforce civil rights and things like that, so they would bend over backwards to find standing, and now it's the conservatives who are bending over backwards to find standing, to rein in the administrative state, etc.
Right. I mean, so, you know, if we look historically, particularly during the civil rights era, we can see, you know, a real push from, you know, Democratic appointed justices and those representing progressive issues to have access to the courts. And so if you think about environmental law as sort of the easiest way to see this historically, you know, if you think that the Environmental Protection Agency has interpreted one of its statutes in a way that is harmful to the environment, your recourse is going to be to the courts. And so there's this real push on, you know, sort of left-leaning justices and entities to say that courts should be open to these kinds of claims so that there can be some kind of redress. And then on the flip side, you know, of course, Republican interests who want to limit that would say there isn't standing, particularly, again, in these environmental cases. Now we really see that flipped on its head where, you know, a 6-3 conservative majority is really saying we want to sort of tackle issues that maybe in the past we would have said there's no standing for. But, you know, just on the other side of the coin, it seems like, you know, the Democratic appointees have flipped positions as well and are now arguing that the court should really stay out of these cases, that this is something that should be left to the political branches.
And Brookings Institution fellow Scott Anderson told you, this really struck me. The result has been a hodgepodge of case law where standing in areas like environmental law is harder to establish than in administrative law and others targeted by conservatives. That's concerning.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of these cases or one of the instances where this comes up a lot is whether or not states have the ability to intervene in these cases or to bring these cases that are challenges to the federal government. You know, we've seen a wave of cases in the Supreme Court that really challenge presidential policies, both on the right and the left. We saw a lot of it under President Obama, then certainly under President Trump, and now under President Biden, where states are asking the Supreme Court to invalidate what is essentially a very big political issue. And so that's sort of one of the biggest areas where we see these hodgepodges is when states intervene, both in administrative law cases and in environmental law cases, as Scott Anderson mentioned.
And a great example of that is when the Supreme Court took up President Joe Biden's student loan forgiveness program. And I remember before the case was argued, a lot of people said, there's no way that they're going to find standing here. But then they did find standing. So tell us how they found standing.
That's right. So actually, there were two different cases that I think really bring this point home that the court was considering at the same time. One was brought by two individuals who had not been eligible for the student loan forgiveness program, and they challenged the law saying that they should be eligible. And a unanimous court said that's not enough to give you standing in a case that would really open up, you know, the challenge to almost everybody who's ever taken out student loans. And so, you know, we saw a 9-0 court say there's no standing there. But where the justices split was on a separate case where Missouri was claiming that it had set up an independent corporation to deal with student loans. And because they could lose some revenue, that Missouri, the state, should have standing. Importantly, you know, the corporation there that Missouri had set up had not challenged the student loan program. And so, you know, the justices split along ideological lines on whether or not Missouri had a strong enough interest in that case. Ultimately, you know, the conservatives won in that case. And not only did they find standing, but they struck down one of President Biden's key policy issues.
And Justice Kagan, Elena Kagan, criticized the majority, saying, quote, at the behest of a party that has suffered no injury, the majority decides a contested public policy issue properly belonging to the politically accountable branches and the people they represent. In one sentence, summing up the problem we've been talking about here. Coming up, we have this battle over the abortion pill that provides one of the clearest examples of what we've been discussing about standing.
That's right. And so, you know, this is the case over whether or not the FDA's sort of loosening of regulations over mifepristone, one of the drugs used for early term abortions, the most popular form of abortion in the country, whether or not those easing of regulation was legal. And the group or the people who have brought this challenge are a group of anti-abortion doctors who don't actually prescribe mifepristone. You know, their argument is that there are some complications that happen with mifepristone, even if it's very small, and that there might have to treat a patient who has taken it, has taken this drug, and that that would harm sort of their own personal beliefs. And, you know, the Fifth Circuit, you know, which sits in the South, has increasingly become sort of a conservative homestead where people bring these claims because they have really had expansive views of standing, because they have had a conservative view of the merits. And they found that the doctors here did have standing. And so we see in the briefing at the Supreme Court that in addition to sort of talking about the merits of the case, standing is really a key issue here for the Biden administration that's arguing on behalf of the FDA to keep these regulations or the loosening of these regulations in place.
The professors that you talk to about this particular case, do a majority think that the doctors don't have standing here?
Yeah, I think of the people that I spoke to, they said this is really a bridge too far. There are cases out there where it's hard to tell if a party has standing. There's sort of maybe 50-50, 51-49. There are these close cases, you know, that are really questionable. But they say this is not one of them. And I think actually that sort of realization is one reason why we have, again, the state of Missouri asking the justices if they can intervene in the case to sort of relieve some of those standing problems. Now, the Biden administration says that Missouri itself has, you know, its own standing problems. But, you know, the point is that we see sort of people who are arguing to make it harder to get access to mifepristone. They sort of see that there are some standing challenges in the case, at least with regard to the doctors.
Missouri wants to intervene. And has the Fifth Circuit said that they have standing too, or hasn't that gone to the Fifth Circuit?
Well, the lower court has said that they can intervene, but, you know, this case has already been up at the Supreme Court. It's already had briefing. As I mentioned, you know, a big part of the argument on both sides is whether or not these doctors have standing. The question of whether or not Missouri has standing is very different. You know, I mentioned the whole idea of state standing is really part of this hodgepodge of standing doctrine. If you talk to anyone who's really steeped in this issue, you know, and try to find a through line, they say there really isn't one at this point. It's an issue that the court is really sort of grappling with. And so at least the Biden administration is arguing that it's just too late. Yes, it sort of bypasses some of the standing problems that the doctors have, but it creates new standing issues that just haven't been briefed yet between the parties.
I don't think standing is a concept that most people outside the legal community who aren't following these cases closely grasp. Do you think it's too technical or too procedural?
Yeah, I mean, it's not that it's just so technical either. It's also that it's a really fuzzy concept. And so it comes from this phrase in the Constitution that requires that, you know, Article III courts have only hear, quote, cases and controversies. And, you know, what a case and controversy really means, like I said, is really fuzzy. And so that provides a lot of wiggle room for the justices. And I think it's, you know, really interesting to note as we talk about this issue that it's not just flip-flopping on one side of the issue, but it's really wholesale flip-flopping from both those on the right and the left who sort of see standing in a totally different way based on the composition of the court.
It's such an interesting and important concept, Kimberly. Thanks so much for coming on. That's Bloomberg Supreme Court reporter Kimberly Strawbridge Robinson.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.